Okay, guten Abend, willkommen nach Acid Horizon. Ich bin Adam, and today we are talking about the poetry of class. We're going back to the mid-century Germany, like we did with the Thesis on Feuerbach episode, because we want to get in some of the real meat of where a lot of these debates about Marxism, socialism, revolution, and the revolutionary subject coincide. As Marx and Engels said at the end of the Communist Manifesto, workers of the world unite. We have nothing to lose but our chains. But just who is this we? How do we identify the proletariat, the revolutionary subject, and how does the proletariat identify itself in the midst of the intensifying threat of economic precarity and capitalist ruin? This we, to quote the socialist thinker Wilhelm Weitling, is a tricky question. But today we're going to take a dive into the historical materialism series with the latest book, The Poetry of Class, Romantic Anti-Capitalism, and the Invention of the Proletariat. And I am just be joined by both the author, Patrick Eidenhofer, and the book's translator, Jacob Blumenfeld, who you may remember from every time I've ever spoken about Max Stirner on this channel. Patrick, Jacob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's just start by unpacking this term, poetry of class, and particularly its origins, Patrick, in your analysis of the work of the sort of left Hegelian, or left post-Hegelian maybe thinker, Eduard Ganz, in the 1830s. Because the idea is that the poetry of class is a term which is situated against an idea from Hegel of what he calls, to summarize it, the prose of circumstances. So what does it mean to talk about the poetry of class and the poetics of class? And how does this sort of original tension between poetry and prose, class and circumstance, how does that motivate the dialectic that unfolds throughout your book in terms of giving a kind of literary history of class conception and class composition? Sorry, you're muted, Patrick.
So that was one of the starting points, and one of the key starting points of my investigation was that this diagnosis that we live in the prosaic times, that we live in prosaic times, and under the prose of circumstances, which was given by Hegel in his lectures in the 1820s, that was somehow shared by everyone in the 1830s. Everybody agreed that we live in prosaic times. And then the question was, well, how to react to it? And everybody, again, agreed, even the liberals, the conservatives, the more progressive ones, agreed that we need a new poetry in life. We need a poetization of life. And the question was, where do we get it from? So there was this classic romantic answer was, we get it from nature. And some said we need to find green islands in the gray prose of the present time, and the most advanced answer I think is that you find the poetry of our present time exactly at that point where you think the prosa is the most prosaic. So and what can be more prosaic than the division of labor? So I mean what is somehow the essence of the prose of contemporary is that we live in a capitalist society, in a society where work doesn't mean anything in itself anymore. We live in a society that is characterized by a division of labor, and therefore by a developing class society, and persons like Ganz and a few others said, okay, well, this is exactly the point where we have to start with a new poetry of our present time. So it is not something apart from these prosaic things, but exactly where the prosa is at its most trayest point. There we have to go and find this new source for poetry. And this is what Ganz and others then said, and also these guys in the early in this what then later became the labor movement. They said, okay, we have to find the source for a new poetry, exactly in the division of labor, exactly in the most alienated sphere of public life. We have to go there and find poetry there. And this is what some of these, what very many of these people I'm writing about are sharing common. This idea that we need a new poetry, which was pretty common among everyone, about pretty everybody at that time. and we have to find it in this sphere, in this most alienated sphere of class division. And of course, it was the proletariat as the most alienated class that had the most, that had the best preconditions to develop this new poetry.
One of the terms actually I'd like to pick up on, you mentioned romantic, and of course the subtitle is, you know, romantic anti-capitalism, yeah, and the image of the proletariat. Are the figures that you cover in this book predominantly, would you say, articulate a politics of the proletariat in a kind of romantic way? And what does it mean to put it in a romantic way?
Yeah, that's difficult. I mean, this is also contested somehow because, you know, there's a long tradition of anti-romanticism from Hegel on to the Marxist tradition. And even this term romantic anti-capitalism is meant as something anti-romantic. It was coined by Lukács, and Lukács thinks when he talks about romantic anti-capitalism, he says, okay, we have to acknowledge that it is some kind of anti-capitalism. We have to acknowledge this, that we find it in, for example, in Eichendorff or in Tieck. We find elements that are anti-capitalist, but they are romantic anti-capitalist. That means it is a kind of insufficient anti-capitalism. It's not a real scientific anti-capitalism as Marx developed it or as Hegel developed it. And I try to rescue this term of romantic anti-capitalism. I say that a certain impetus of anti-capitalism can only be romantic, and that the romanticism, at least by that time in the 1830s and 40s, there was practically no way to articulate an anti-capitalist stance without referring to a romantic rhetoric, at least. And so I think there is something more to it. It's not just to say that it was necessary in the 1830s and 40s, and then we can overcome it. This is the classical Marxist narrative, to say there's something we need for a certain moment, but then we overcome it, we translate it. And I think it's something that keeps pertinent somehow, because it articulates a certain critique that is we are unable to articulate without. And this is exactly, again, the question of the poetic. How can you articulate a critique of capitalism that is not just that not redoubles somehow the prosaic aspect of capitalism? So if capitalism is the society, the social form of prose per se, you can say, okay, we can be more prosaic than prose. We can develop the real prose of the circumstances against the capitalist half prose or something. Or we can say we need something that is really counters this prosaic aspect of life and bring something new or something old back. You need a vocabulary about what it is, what you want to mobilize against capitalism, and what is associated with prose, with poetry in opposed to prose. I think it's a moment of unpredictability, the possibility that something new might happen, that something that you were not able to foresee. This is something that is essentially what people felt by that time, what was lost in their life. The possibility of the possibility that something can happen, the unpredictability was lost, and something then they use words like the magic or the that's a certain difficult vocabulary, of course, but it's things that are not homogeneous with this capitalist life, something that is radically different to this form of capitalist life, and this radical difference is articulated in this vocabulary of the poetry and of poetry and of, yeah. But Jacob, you wanted to add something, right?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, before I started translating the book, I was very skeptical of this idea of romantic anti-capitalism. I mean, because it just comes with so much baggage and so much criticism. That to be a romantic anti-capitalist is to fetishize nature, fetishize the past, to want to go to the past, to want to go backwards, to be small scale, to give up modernity, right? To return to something that never existed, to go backwards. And this is what we've learned from like 100 years of struggle. This is like a false path, right? This leads to danger, to doom, whether to small scale projects that falter out or to, you know, those kinds of fascistic movements that tend to think that we need to get to our roots in something before this abstractions of modernity. But what you know, as I started translating it, and what I saw as Patrick's project is to kind of differentiate a kind of romanticism, does not kind of fetishize the past. I mean, this is it uses the past as a template of critique for the present towards a future. And this is the difficult thing with this kind of romanticism. That's not a reactionary romanticism, right? It's a moment of critique, or it's a method of critique and an element of struggle that I would say differentiates this account from other accounts of romantic anti-capitalism, perhaps like Lukács's critique. So I think it's a welcome contribution to rethinking these categories and challenging for people who have grown up thinking that this is something to be abandoned and dismissed.
No, I completely agree, especially when it comes to these ideas that using it as a template critique. I mean, the idea of the poetry of class, as you articulate it, Patrick, is so tied up to the idea of the constant precarity, the idea that you need a way of narrativizing the ruin which is constantly being forced upon you. Not because, in a way, the present has lost its identity with the past, but because the present is laden with contradictions which are propelling it from the past to today, to which we cannot necessarily go back to. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. always confront us in the present. The prose of, you know, we fall in between the gaps between the words that write out the prose of circumstance. This prose is the prose of orders, commands, economic forecasts. And it does remind me a little bit of this quote from Agamben, you know, that terminology is the poetic moment in thought, where you create a new term. And of course, to take it away from the idealist reading, this is because it is all happening in the time which we're, you know, it's under consideration here. So let's dive into this time of revolutionary romantics and romantic revolutionaries and talk about the Vormeers period. So predominantly Anglophone audience, I didn't know much about this period until I started my PhD, and I still really don't. What was the Vormeers? What was Europe like around the time of, you know, let's say 1830 as a cutoff point? I know it's always a hard thing to cut off. 1830 to 1848. And why do we need to turn to the Vormeers? I'm opening this question up to, of course, both of you, because, I mean, it's central to all three of our works that there's something that we haven't quite grasped or haven't quite resolved in the mm-hmm. various ways in which socialism was coming about through this period and all the debates that, in many ways, I think we're still having. So what was the Vormeers, and why is it so central to the work here?
Yeah, I mean, to put it literally, it's the time before March. It's the time before the March Revolution of 1848. So if you haven't had a March Revolution, so it's not very, very interesting to talk about the format. So if you have to, in the UK, you had no March Revolution, but you had a March Revolution all over Europe, basically, except for France, where they started a month earlier in February. And so you have a time. You can say it started in 1830, but you can also already say it started after the Viennese, after the Congress of Vienna in 1815 or something. So it's a kind of roughly the first half of the 19th century after the Napoleonic Wars. And it's the time that it is somehow preparing this revolution. I mean, there's been lots of discussions whether it's okay to name this whole period of history after an event that only happens afterwards. So is it correct to call people who lived, let's say, in 1838, that they lived in the formats, but it took 10 more years to go to the Mats, to the March Revolution? And of course, it's not completely okay in a scholarly way, perhaps. But I think that the expression is very good. The name is very good, because actually, I think everybody in that time thought and felt that they lived in a kind of pre-revolutionary situation. Everybody knew that the revolution had to come, whether it is in March or in April or May, that doesn't matter. But it was clear that this revolution was going to come, and it was a kind of a very tenuous time. And this is something that you can find in every expression of that period, be it artistic, be it philosophical, be it political. The interesting thing is that most of the things that really became interesting and important in the second half of the 19th century somehow were prepared and started in the formats in the time before 48. And it's also, it's difficult. So it's on the one hand, it's clear that you have to talk about the formats, but on the other hand, it's very difficult to how to do it. Because if you talk about it, as they say, okay, everything that became important afterwards was prepared in the formats, then you have only to tell again the story of a preparational period, a transitional period that led to something big. And on the other hand, if you don't refer to it, then it's difficult to say why it is important. And so this is a kind of, you have from the beginning a problem how you talk about the formats, how you refer to that time that was a transitionary period, but by no doubt. But it doesn't exhaust itself in being a transition to something different. And so, the interesting thing is that most of the people that became important revolutionaries in the second half of the 19th century, call them Karl Marx, call them Friedrich Engels, call them Moses Hess, call them Stirner afterwards. I don't know, but most of these people had their beginnings in the formats, and lots of people who were important in the formats are forgotten today. And so you have, I've tried to tell the story of the formats as a period where all these people that are totally forgotten today, and those people who we say were became classics of revolutionary thought, were all the same still, were somehow all the same. They published in the same newspapers, they met in the same bars, they met at the same meetings, they were practically the same. Nobody knew that Karl Marx was going to be the big founder of Marxism, while Heinrich Püttmann will go to exile in the US and will be forgotten. When they met in 1844, they were equal. And maybe even Heinrich Püttmann was more important because he was the publisher and Karl Marx wanted his stuff to be published. So I wanted to take them back to a period where they are all basically the same, where they are all belonging to the same revolutionary scene, and want to treat the texts like if they were the same. I mean, everybody in the late 1840s knew that Marx was a special case, that he was a big thing, that everybody realized it at a certain moment. But at the same time, he wrote his texts and he published them along with other texts in the same journals. And so I had my focus on these journals that were published by that time, because they are kind of arena where you can see that there were lots of different things around, and there was no sorting yet has happened. What is important? What is not important? What will be forgotten? What is literature? What is pure? What is real theory? This was all intermingled somehow by that time, and I wanted to get a glimpse at this situation, because then I think it's possible to reevaluate in a new way what maybe is possible important today and what can be forgotten today. So if we don't rely on the sorting that had happened in the last 150 years, and you have to prepare your material in a way that you bring yourself in a position that you can have a fresh look at it, and that was the thing that I tried in my book, and that was a contest.
Patrick, in his work, he looks mostly at literature or different literary forms, journals, plays, novels, statistical reports, reportage, memoirs, biographies, and he's showing, you know, how all these different kinds of texts reflect or express the new formation of class that's occurring. In my work that covers this period, I really only look at philosophical texts and philosophers, and how the kind of the philosophical texts of the 1840s, whether from Feuerbach or Stirner or Marx or Bauer, how they reflect and express these tendencies of proletarianization, of class, and how they get reflected in thought, and you know whether it's the idea of critique, you know, or the idea of humanism, communism, of socialism, of liberalism, of the state, of work itself. So you can really see in the philosophical categories that are, you know, circulating in this period in all these texts and journals, in which there's dialogues back and forth between, you know, Marx, Bauer, Stirner, Marx and Hess, you know, together, then apart, Marx and Weitling together, then apart, Engels and Weitling, Engels and Stirner. So they're all kind of fighting and coming together. And if you read these texts without this idea that it leads to this one path, you see this plurality, this heterogeneity of thinking, of critical thought, which is all part of this kind of tendency of industrialization, proletarianization, thinking through what this means, trying to find ways out of it already, even before it's complete, right? Already at the beginning of the formation of class, there's an attempt to escape it, both in practice and in thought. And then some people think, you know, there's only people who do in thought and only those who do in practice. And then there's people who do both or neither. So I find this period very fascinating. And, you know, as they say in German, prägnant, or it's like pregnant or, you know, contains multitudes that get separated out later into ideologies or fixed ideas or, you know, static ways of thinking in the second half of the 19th century and in the 20th century. You know, we still, political ideologies still reference these terms, still come back to them. So here's a really interesting point in time when they're formulated, discussed, and a bit more free and loose in terms of their fixity, right? The question of who is a proletarian, it's a key topic in Patrick's book, is not settled in the beginning, right? It's a bit of an open category. Does it include civil servants, teachers, workers, military, citizens? Like, what does it mean to be a proletarian? And how do you even spell the word? The spelling of the word is actually also up for debate. Is there an E or is there an A? Or is it proletari? I love this kind of play of terminology and categorization. And how do you count the proletariat? It's also a big topic that Patrick discusses, right? How do you, what's the mechanism of counting? Do you count income? Do you count kids? Do you count poor? So this is all, you know, fluid and doesn't get like turned into these fixed categories of you're in this class, you're in this class.
Absolutely. I mean, me and Patrick were talking about this before we started recording, that so many of the debates we see, at least in my experience, on sort of the Anglophone terminally online left, is who is a proletariat? Are baristas proletarian? What about farmers? You know, it's sociologically putting all these debates in to fix as many categories as possible. And whilst it does make like a lot of homework, but these debates, these positions from everyone around the Vormir's period, we can always see that these debates reaffirm themselves or just reappear almost like archetypes. You know, okay, over there, that person's having the LaSalle debate. They've just said that labor is entitled to all wealth it creates. Okay, that's LaSalle. Okay, someone's being Marx versus LaSalle over here. Oh dear, someone's going to be Bruno Bauer for a bit. Oh look, there's Feuerbach over there. Like, there's so many questions which reappear and reformulate themselves because we still don't have the answers to these questions, but it's because the material conditions that produce them are just so enduring. And yeah, let's absolutely get into this question of who is the proletariat and how, Patrick, you look at it through a kind of analysis of the social critical literature in which, so the revolutionary subject, or at least those, you know, how we analyze it as like an embryonic, exactly, you know, pregnant sort of insurrectionary mass. So can we start with a history of the concept or even the term of the proletariat? And then maybe we can move throughout sort of how it gets picked up for these various attempts, you know, from the initial ways in which people try to disavow the term proletariat. You talk about Arnold Ruge and his attempts with the young Hegelians, say, we're not proletarians, we're just, you know, we're just journalists. And then, you know, various ways which it's disavowed through stuff like the Bürgerbuch, with the affirmation of, no, we're city dwellers, we're not proles. And then Weitling shows up with a steel chair, you know, so to say, and basically says, you know, we are the proletariat, and has this grand sort of collectivity there. And it's a lot of the book is a history up to this point, and beyond, of course, but definitely much up to this point in terms of the you know, the gedicta, the literal thickening of the term proletariat. So I'd love to sort of take us on a bit of a journey through that.
The interesting thing is that the proletariat was not a concept at first, where you can say it has a characteristic, an essence that then unfolds in it in empirically or something. It's not the Hegelian idea that you have a concept that it had it all in it and then it unfolds in reality and realizes itself in reality. But it's not a concept, I think, but it's just a name. It's a name that was given to a certain collective to a group where nobody could define whether this where the borders of this group is, where who belongs to the group, and whether it is one group or it's a multitude of groups somehow. And I mean, I use the term of assembling the proletariat. That is something that Weitling does. And I mean, I used it somehow deliberately, but also kind of tongue in cheek, alluding to, for example, Bruno Latour assembling the social, but also these terms of assembly, these books on assembly, Art Mekri wrote a book on the assembly, but also this notion of assemblage as a kind of artistic technique. So it's a kind of, that is all in play here. If you see how this term, this name, proletariat was set in motion somehow in the formats, they somehow all agreed that this is the correct name, but nobody could say why exactly. It was a pure process of negotiation about it. I mean, even Rugo says we are not proletarians, accepts that there is something like a proletariat. And even when you say we are Bürger, we are not, then it's kind of giving the proletariat a certain shape. It's not saying we are better than the proletariat. It's that we have to understand the proletariat in a different way so that the Bürger is included in the proletariat. And so it's a kind of reshaping of what this name designates and what it doesn't designate. And it's not so much what it doesn't designate. It's not so much about negating the belonging, but it's a kind of positive assembling gesture of putting people together. And appropriate or adequate form of representation of this kind of collectivity that is named by the proletariat. So the best representation is not a concept, but a list. The list is the form in which the proletariat is represented. You find these lists again and again. I mean, Jacob, you mentioned them before. So if you want to say who's the proletariat in the formats, you cannot give a definition, but you have to start making lists. And this part, and this part, and this, and the end is the essential operation that is in term at work here. And this is something that I found interesting because it doesn't mean that. At the same time, it's very, let's say, when it comes to conflict, it works. It worked. There were a lot of social conflicts where this vague collective was very strong in this and very fightful. So it is not that it somehow is, it means that this form of collectivity doesn't work in political fights. It works very well. It worked very well. And at the same time, you have no fights about who belongs to it and who doesn't. And this is something that I've found interesting and fascinating. And of course, if you say if you talk about the relevance for today, it is something that occurred to me that I somehow had a feeling I know this. When 15 years ago, when the term of the precariat was used for the first time in political debates of the left, there were some people who tried to define the precariat is duck, duck, duck. And at the same time, there were people who said, no, but this group also belongs to it. And this group is kind of precarious as well. And is this done a certain kind of precariousness also? And so, and then you had this kind of the return of the list. And this is something that I found fascinating. And I think this, I think we have to, perhaps it's a humble gesture. It says we don't have a pure concept now. It's a kind of humble, and also I think it's a more curious gesture. It says, okay, well, who might belong to it as well, and not to pretend to know that there are certain limits. And so this is something that I found interesting historically, but also relevant for a return of these circumstances, which I somehow imply that our situation today is much more like the situation in the formats than it is perhaps the situation in the 1890s or 1930s or something. The 1930s is perhaps a different problem, but I think the idea is that there's a reoccurring relevance of these formats problems, especially it's reoccurring again and again, but it's a certain special relevance today, I think. This is something that you can also see in this representational form of the list.
Once again, thank you, Jacob and Patrick, for coming on the show. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the concept of romantic anti-capitalism and the vindication of it. And I think one of the important things that you bring into the introduction in this book, and one of the things that this book promises, is an engagement with a concept of the proletarian imaginary. And the ways in which the formation of class itself produces this series of heterogeneous myths and narratives. What it really means to me is that there is this immaterial dimension of the material struggle, which is its own arena of contestation. And by attempting to vindicate romantic anti-capitalism, we almost double down on the intensity of that contestation in some way. And the way that I see this as being important for the development of class consciousness is that it articulates what I think is the battleground of class consciousness, which is ultimately epistemological. And there's two figures. Well, the figure of romantic anti-capitalism is kind of up against the figure of Lukács in some ways, as you've spelled it out in the introduction. And Lukács's critique is that the romantic impulse or the romantic imagination lacks the tools by which to adequately grasp the contradictions from which proletarian struggle arises, or any sort of contestation in a capitalist world brings about. But it seems that the claim that you're putting forward, and I'd like to dig into this a little bit more, is that romantic musings of any kind, thinking about the Luddites, for example, there's a way in which the very contingency of location, time, historical or temporal time, is absolutely important to the kinds of imagination that wells up and the manifestations that happen in virtue of the particularities of a local struggle, and to the extent that it gives you a sort of privileged way of knowing the world. And thinking about Lukács, and especially the later Lukács with his work on socialist realism and, you know, the debates about Thomas Mann and Kafka and which sort of literatures truly engage with class consciousness, the question is, how do we negotiate between the divide or the gap of understanding what sort of manifestations of the proletarian imagination are truly moving forward in a positive manner, the struggle against capitalism in a way that would make the proletariat victorious in some way, versus how do we avoid setting up tribunals of cadre power that delimits what the proletarian imagination is supposed to look like? That, to me, that seems to be ultimately what's at stake in valorizing a romantic anti-capitalism. I'm wondering if you agree with that, Patrick.
I mean, Lukács is a difficult point here, because I think in some way, I mean, he uses the term romantic anti-capitalism not totally consistently in the different times he uses this. I think it's what is clear is that he thinks it's somehow an insufficient way of criticizing capitalism. And in some texts, it's romantic anti-capitalism is nearly synonymous with fascist or something. He said that that's a kind of, that is outright reactionary. There are texts about Dostoevsky and Lukács' Stalinist period where it's really, where this just means reactionary. But on the other hand, he has a strong affection for at least the German romantic tradition. I mean, he really loves Eichendorff, and he wrote this book, this essay on Eichendorff in 1940. I mean, four weeks or 6 weeks before he got cancerated by the NKVD, when the war has already started. And he writes an essay about Eichendorff and the good for nothing, and there he uses this term, and it's a kind of saying, okay, this, and he's trying to explain to himself, I think, why this romantic poetry is not totally worthless, because it is a kind of anti-capitalism, but a romantic one, which is insufficient. But on the other hand, there is something about it, and I think just recently read it in the last interview that Lukács gave in 1971, which is called the council system is inevitable. There he comes back to the Luddites and to the machine breakers. And he rescues them. He says, okay, they are, he not only rescues them in a traditional Marxist way, they were necessary to kick off the workers' movement, but then they become superfluous. But he says, they are, and what is at stake is the question of progress. What is progress? Is it really possible to distinguish what is progressive and what is not? And then he says it is the old question of what is the, in the kind of the Gretchenfrage of historical materialism, is the primitive accumulation of capital? Was it a progress or not? And he says, you can't answer this question. You can't answer it. It's impossible to say this was good, it was not good. You can say it brought something about that was really good, and that was the Luddites. And he says you can judge progress. I mean, and so far we had only capitalist progress seen, right? You can judge progress only by the effects it has on and by the forms of resistance it brings about. And this is something that is interesting about romantic anti-capitalism. It is a kind of, it's not a theory, a consistent theory with which you can design a whole new society. I think this must be rubbish. If you start this, you end up in a reactionary utopia. But it is a kind of strong intervention and a kind of saying a resistance against the capitalist progress. And it's a very strong intervention to make clear that there's something fundamentally wrong with capitalist progress. And then this is something that what is wrong with capitalist progress is that it somehow touches spheres that you cannot articulate in a capitalist mode of or in a capitalist language again. I mean, I know you guys are into Bataille, right? I listened to the Bataille to some of the Bataille episodes, and I mean, I quote Bataille in the introduction, and where he says poetry is a synonym for expenditure. Bataille goes on and in the accused chair says the last sphere where really in modernity where social expenditure can be outlived somehow is class conflict. And then of course Bataille is a big friend of a certain kind of romantic anti-capitalist prose, namely William Blake, Exuberance is Beauty, and this is something that is at stake here. I mean it's a kind of what capitalism ultimately does. I mean it doesn't serve people in means of giving them food and a drink but the strongest failure of capitalism is that it is unable to give people a meaningful life. It destroys all meaning in life. It destroys everything that it's worth living for. And this is what these people say. It's not about that the wages are too low and the children are starving. And that, of course, that is the scandal that we have to get rid of first, of course. But that is only the surface. The biggest scandal about capitalism is that it destroys everything life is worth living for. And this is something that you can only grasp in terms that romanticism brought forward, and all this what Bataille calls the heterogeneous of everything that is not in line with the foreseeable. Everything that is not in line with this gets lost in capitalism, and we have to reclaim it. And if we want to reclaim it, we nearly inevitably come to vocabulary of romanticism. We have to come to nature, love, poetry, community. That's the things we were drinking together with friends. That's the things, having long conversations, long meaningless conversations with friends. That is the purpose of life. Family, that is the purpose of life. And that's all that's lost in capitalism. And this is why we need romantic anti-capitalism to really articulate why capitalism is such a, you name it.
If you don't mind, I'd like to follow that up. You put a quote by Rancière in the introduction that I think just works really well. And I'd like to riff off this a bit and get your opinion on a view that it kind of arouses within me. Rancière writes, "The present forms of capitalism, the collapse of the labor market, the destruction of systems of social solidarity, and the precarious nature of employment are creating experiences of work and forms of life that may well be closer to those of the artisans of the past than that world of non-material work and frenetic consumption whose complacent picture we are offered." And it makes me think, this might be a somewhat of a tangent away from Rancière here, but thinking about, for example, how incessantly capitalism deterritorializes every meaning and every code in the social field. And today, especially with young people online, I mean, I recently saw something that's very promising for all of us here in the chat today, that Gen Z is actually turning towards material books in paper format, right? And there's all kinds of TikToks that show people in traditional roles and that sort of thing. And many people on the left react to this in a certain way, you know, by framing it as fascist. But it's not necessarily that they want to return or go back in time. Perhaps it's the case that there's a kind of tangibility or a de-intensification of the capitalist relation that is kind of seeping through that image. Do you think the way that you're trying to reclaim romantic anti-capitalism attends to, you know, some of the things that are happening with young people today online and that sort of thing? And maybe even Jacob, if you'd like to get in there too, by all means.
Yeah, talking about the young people is Jacob's.
I mean, what seems really interesting to me about it is the idea, for example, that, you know, like think about the kinds of labor that, you know, even people like Adam and I do. You know, it's not necessarily in a factory. We have, you know, different things. We work for different people, have, you know, different streams of income and so forth. And often it just kind of keeps us locked in this sort of digital bubble. And the sort of impulse to, you know, the fantasy to get out there and touch grass, as they say, or get into contact with nature seems to me to be something that capitalism continues to preempt in some way. And it seems that the prospect of valorizing or recovering something from romantic anti-capitalism does something of that. And also perhaps it invigorates a revolutionary spirit that we see in the Luddites, where the resistance is direct against the technology. It's direct against the forces that attempt to impose that technology. And to me, that seems to be something that's absent from the narrative of progress.
I mean, if I could give an example of that as well, I mean, just from my own experiences, a big radicalizing thing for people of my generation and younger, and for all its faults, was corporatism in the UK. And the common refrain was that this is going to take us back to the 1970s. And it's not that anyone in my generation wanted to go back to the 1970s in Britain, and it's still a post-colonial, incredibly sort of horrible place to be, especially if you're a migrant or anyone from the imperial periphery. But yeah, there's always a horrible but put after that, isn't there? But again, the idea of, you know, having home ownership, not simply devoting your entire life to work or being, you know, a constant being enslaved to or ensnared within apparatuses of debt, for example, like we were talking on the last episode. I think that's kind of a romantic anti-capitalism there to some extent. That might be a good sort of example to think about the youth for as long as I may or may not be a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the essential gesture of this romantic anti-capitalism is that you hold on to the idea that there is something outside of the capitalist system, and you have a kind of way to break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side where the capitalism is not yet or not any longer. Where you have, this is the idea that there is, and of course the bureaucrats of the system, be they Marxist or be they liberal, they always say there's no outside, there's nothing different, and if you want to get out of it, you have to get through it, and then this is all this what the Marxists tell you, and the romantic anti-capitalist gesture is no, there is something outside, and we can go there. We can. So this is something like it, and this is what the early workers did. I mean, this is what Rancière writes about. They found it at night. They had to work all day, and they had to sleep all night to work, to be able to work all day. And so they didn't sleep all night. They just walked out. They wrote poems together, and I have it in this. We have this is a great text on the flower festival of the English workers. Is that okay? We live in Bradford in the 1840s. That was kind of the archetypical capitalist nightmare city for these people. It was all gray and all in dust and all in. And then you can go out. You can go out to this hill outside and take part in a collective festival of flowers, of flower growing. And this is something the theoreticians can tell you there is no, that isn't possible. Even if you're there, you're still somehow in the capitalist framework of thinking or whatever. And he says, no, we go outside and we do something different. And the interesting thing is, in the romantic anti-capitalism that I'm interested in, that this outside where you can go and do something, you can do it. You have to do it together with other people. It's not an escapistic thing, is a solipsistic thing that you can do for your own, just go to in the inner space or something and be, but you have to share it with people. It's about sharing, it's about being together with other people, and then in the very moment you state there is something, you do it, you create it in the very moment you say there is, it is there. So it's a performative, somewhat performative aspect to it. And this is something that is in this, that is, and then this is also, I think it's theoretically interesting because it also leads to a kind of, and politically interesting because it leads to a certain conception of revolution. It's not something that is where we have to work on the preconditions and at a certain moment you say the moment is ripe, but it's just something that you do and you come together and then you do it. This is a kind of course, this is problematic. This is the big but that always follows. And maybe it's you can't organize a big workers' party on these terms. And maybe it isn't even possible to have a real revolution that really destroys commodity farm in that way. Maybe it's not possible. But if you forget it altogether, then maybe this big revolution isn't worth it either. So this is something that is it's about. I think it's about this gesture of saying it is there and thereby doing it and doing it together. Getting I mean that's one of my favorite quotes by Albert Hirschman. You know, we're getting ahead collectively. That's the only idea of progress that we can accept.
Yeah, I think what in Patrick's book there's all these characters that wander. You know, there's these Gesellen, there's these wanderers, these carpenters that wander through Europe and they learn revolutionary ideas from France, from other countries. You know, there's no revolutionary tradition in Germany, so they have to go elsewhere to find it, and they bring it back. And they translate it, and they translate in different ways, and they mix up things as they do, and they just wander and they leave, and they discover things on their journeys. And this tradition still exists, actually, in Germany. You still see these people making their Wanderjahre. But there's also people that escape into the woods to hold meetings, or they go into nature to tell stories. They do these flower festivals, or they break machines, right? They smash the machines of the master if they want to, and they celebrate it, you know, in the forest, in the woods. And I think what this shows is there's a poetic moment in the composition of the class. It's not the whole, it's not the totality, right? I think that this is the danger. It's like, it's not the absolute. It's not like class struggle, class formation is only poetic, right? There is some science there. There's a science of insurrection. but there is a poetic moment of coming together, composing oneself, expressing oneself in different ways that are unpredictable, contingent, give meaning, and that try to escape in a sense. I mean, this recurs, you know, this recurs throughout history since then up into the present. It's also very contradictory. I think there's both a desire for escape, for tangibility, for meaning. There's also a desire for stability, right? Security, tradition, right. So there's both like excitement and stability at the same time. You want to escape the precarity of this form of life. You also want to experience new things. So this romantic, this poetic romantic formation is contradictory, and it has both tendencies within it, and that expresses itself in different figures and different philosophies. In different literary expressions, like whether it's narrative or statistics, whether it's Marx or I don't know, Putman or Herweg or Georg Wert or the Ludotique, right? All these different figures are expressing these different ways, and it's not always contradictory. Sometimes it's just like a juxtaposition, like they're just both there together, and you just need to choose. And I think these juxtapositions of conflict, of struggle, of class consciousness, class formation. Are completely there today, you know, in people's desire to connect through these hyper individualized forms of digital media. It's a very contradictory expression, right? Or to go in the streets and connect, but without any organization or institution. It's also a form of like contradictory. And I would think, these are important moments to not ignore and brush under history, but to really get deeper into and to figure out what they mean and how to give them room to move, as Marx once said about contradiction.
Mm-hmm. There's almost a constant remnant that reminds. I mean, I know this term comes from Patrick's book as well, but also a phrase I take from your work, Jacob, on Stirner, which is first person Marxism, the aspect of the first person. There's almost a kind of a Adornian negative dialectic there of the thing which always resists total subsumption into a grand total flat concept, or even, you know, for folks into Bloch, the warm stream versus the cold stream of Marxism. But I know it says we're coming up to the hour. There's one quote, actually, I just want to read from the conclusion of the book, which is, the labor struggle, every labor struggle, also bears traces of poetry because it causes an interruption of the ruling prose of circumstances. The labor struggle is and remains poetic because, as an interruption, it harbors an element of unpredictability. No matter how rigidly the bureaucrats of the revolution in the established workers' parties and unions try to banish this element. And the conclusion is, I mean, I love the conclusion because it joins some of my favorite things, which is, you know, 1848 Germany to contemporary forms of class struggle articulated in what is, I guess, a kind of a dying form, which is the journal. I mean, one example you give is the Invisible Committee in sort of the good side of anti-capitalism. On the bad side of things that go awry, we have the singular individualism of Mr. Ted Kaczynski, of course. But I just wanted to ask, actually, where would you both see these aspects of the poetry of class arriving today? Does the 20th century have, you know, a Gesellschaftsspiegel? Does it have a Bürgerbuch? Does it have some? Are there movements like this, processes like this, journals like this, you know, literary cultures like this about today? And if so, how do we cultivate more of them? Or how do we open ourselves up to the possibility of partaking in such collectivities ourselves?
I mean, the preoccupation with journals is something personal for me. I think my whole political history in the last 30 years or something was centered around projects of publishing journals. So, and not journals that already existed, but actually we did something. We did stuff like the people in the formats getting together with a few people and say we want to publish our text, so we need a new journal to publish them. It's not, there is no journal that is appropriate for our text. And maybe the other journals wouldn't print them anyway. So, and this is, I mean, you can say it's a strange, people always say it's a kind of, it's the preoccupation of a left that has no real revolutionary duties. Then they publish their journals. I mean, I give us a quotation of the fascist German theoretician, Karl Schmidt. He said about the Romantics, their deeds were journals. So, and he says that the only thing they did was publish journals. But I want to rescue the journal publishing as a genuine revolutionary deed somehow. It's a kind of, if you don't want to found a party or become member of a party and still have a collective that does something in essentially perhaps non-revolutionary times, publishing a journal and discussing about publishing, doing a journal and finding people you can do it together. And it's a kind of practical thing. And it's not something just about discussing endlessly. And then at the end of the day, somewhere we will publish this book, but it says, okay, we'll have to publish this journal by the end of this year. So there's something kind of, let me say, something provisional in it. And so this is something that I really like about this practice, this leftist practice of founding journals and publishing them, even if they are, if you only publish three volumes and then the journal is vanishing again. So this is something I'm interested in. And of course, I mean, I'm a kind of pre-digital native. What people do in the internet, I mean, it's not that different in some respect. There is this good old fashioned kind of journal thing, even in the internet without paper. And I think lots of journals are still published in. So it's not about really about the journal as such, but it's about the social form that condenses in this journal making thing. So this is something I want to, I want to cherish somehow. I want to say this is important. This is good. This is something continue. But of course it's not enough. It's many. You can say that. But there has to be something. There has to be something more. But this must be. That would be a different question. But maybe it's Jacob would add something, and then we can go on.
I think there are a lot of magazines these days, but not a lot of journals. to publish something, you need to take this form of the magazine, which has subscriptions, and then you sell it. It's just hard to commit to a journal project that's kind of non-commercial. You do it over years with friends, and you develop kind of ways of thinking. It's a long, slow process that doesn't fit the timescale of like work today. of commitment of politics of like the of the election cycle, you know, of the day-to-day like news. So people do there's tons of online commentators like every week or blogs or Substacks or whatever. And these are really good for keeping up with the day-to-day, like our podcasts, but like a journal that can really think collectively or with contributors over time, I think are somewhat rare, but they're definitely there. I'll just name one that I really like is EndNotes in English, which is a, you know, collective project with people in different countries thinking together these questions of what is the surplus population today? What does class today mean? What does deindustrialization look like? What does class struggle in the time of deindustrialization look like? How does it take place? How does it mediated by the family form or by race? So, and their issues come out, I think, like once every 5 years. So, you know, it takes a long time to collectively produce a text. And so I like that time scale. But there's other ones that I can name. I'll just name that one. And just another example of not a journal, but kind of a things happening in the world that have this poetic moment. I mean, I just noticed today that there was a group of people in San Francisco, in Chinatown, that attacked a self-driving car that was driving through a Chinese New Year parade, and it's called Waymo, and the car got stuck, and people just went crazy and just torched it and turned it over. So there's some practical Ludditism against AI, against the automated, you know, forms of delivery happening in the streets today. Completely chaotic, and who knows what their interests are and whether or not that's, you know, what class formation. But there's always these moments there, and you can't deny them.
Well, I don't want to be too self-referential, and I know podcasts are often the object of disparagement, but one thing that we have found as a group and as an assemblage with Acid Horizon is that we're not only a podcast, but we interact with folks who support us. This is very common. We're not the only one of this kind. You know, there's just sprawling affinity groups of people who are connected to Patreon accounts and so forth. But what we have found is, you know, very productive conversations happening in reading groups that then, in our case, some of those things turn into publications or ideas for publications. And when I travel, you know, just announcing it on Twitter, I'll meet with followers. The very first time that Adam, Will, and I got together, we all went to a pro-Palestine protest with our friends from the podcast. So it's this very sort of nebulous membrane that we exist within, but something more, of course, needs to be done. But like for us, it's been a start to kind of create a network of sympathetic folks, you know, who are publishing together, talking together, and maintaining these connections online. So I don't know if this is completely analogous to the journal, but I certainly hope it has the same sort of effect and sentiment that it does for Patrick. But
the journal as well is something which has been kind of monopolized upon by the party form recently. I mean, I don't know if it's the same in Germany, but there are about too many to count, really, sort of Trotskyite sort of sects in the UK, and almost all of them, bar some notable and good exceptions like the comrades over RS21, all have newspapers. Not necessarily big, but is that the newspaper is kind of the stereotypical, diffused, delimited form of proletarian or proletarian supportive writing today. And to that extent, I mean, it's maybe we do need to liberate the literary from the capture in the party form. But at the same time, it has been more that the ability to do so has been more diffuse than ever before. It's become individualized through the branding of the internet. You know, everyone writes, a Twitter account is a site of production the same way as a Substack is. And I guess it is these moments of finding these breaks, these points of expenditure. But I know we're getting up to the hour. I mean, just to close things off, I mean, are you working on anything at the moment? I know, Jacob, your latest book is, I think it's already out, on the development of the concept of private property in German idealism from Fichte onwards, I believe. And if you've got any time to talk about that, yes. Patrick, I mean, I know you both did a talk at HM as well. I mean, what's next for this project?
I'm writing a biography of Georg Lukács. So I stick to the topic somehow. Yeah, that is something I came back again and again over the last decade. So, and then I thought that it's time to do this now. But it will take some more years, I think. I hope maybe it's finished in 2 years or something. So it's a kind of it's a big book. Yeah, and I published a kind of personal reading of Hegel's logic in between. So it was a kind of attempt to unleash the heterogeneous in Hegel system somehow. So this was published in German 3 years ago, and we tried to find an English publisher for it now. We have a not Jacob, but another guy will translate it. So maybe this will come out in the UK also in 2 years or something. So this is the stuff I'm running. And I've got an interesting project on, which is somehow the actualization of this of all these formats of stuff somehow, on the political novel in Europe in the contemporary age. So it's a kind of collaborative project with people from different countries, and we're asking what is the political novel in the present time. Is there something like, can you define it, or what does it mean to read a novel as a political novel and to write a political novel nowadays, and what is the impact of it perhaps? Yeah. So these are the things I'm working on. So it's still literature and it's still politics, and I can't let go.
My book on the concept of property in Konflikt and Hegel came out recently. It's kind of a philosophical reconstruction of the thinking through of property after the French Revolution. So in the 1790s and early 1800s, the young Hegel and the Fichte and Kant. My first book was on Stirner, which is, you know, the 1840s. So in the formats, and my next project is on the German Revolution and the fall, you know, the period after the German Revolution. So I always stick by revolutions, whether French 1848 or 1919. And this is going to be about the concept of socialization, and what does it mean to socialize property, to socialize the means of production, and how did this term arise in this post-revolutionary period, and how to get picked up and theorized by councilists, by communists, by conservatives, by elites, by the Frankfurt School. So a lot of the ideas of socialism, of planning, of the market, kind of are formed there, and I'm trying to think through that. The relevance of that term for today in times of climate catastrophe, particularly.
This is all very, just to put it in loose terms, all very much my shit. I'm excited for all of this. I mean, in terms of the pain my wallet felt when I thought about buying all these books, when is the paperback of Poetry of Class coming out?
It's 1 year after the publication of the hardcover, so it should be in October or November this year. So this is what they promised me, so...
And we'll boost that as soon as it's out. But there's nothing left to do in the meantime but say, Patrick, Jacob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. It was really fun.
Thank you.